got to update my Facebook. How much time do you have left? Yeah, I know you guys are waiting to eat dinner, and I...
30 minutes.
Don't tell me that. Seriously, how much time you got? 20 minutes? 15 minutes? What?
Half hour.
Half hour?
Yeah.
I can do some damage in a half an hour. Excuse me. Good evening. My name is Bill Heckman. I'm an addict. I'm, I feel privileged to be here among you. I thank you, Gil, for the invitation to come here. I was really enjoying your share. I'm sorry you cut it short. Maybe you had another half hour you could have gone.
God stops and God stops.
I'm celebrating today 29 days, 8 months, and 7 years of continuous clean time. And so I guess maybe in another 3 months and a day, I'll catch up with you. I feel really privileged to be here. I found one of the most significant changes that's occurred in my life in the last 7.5 years or so is trying to learn how to have a relationship with a power greater than myself. And one of the things that I really had to learn when I got here was how to pray. And I hope this doesn't make you uncomfortable, but I'd like to start off, if I could share with you, this is a kind of a template, kind of a standard prayer that I typically do most nights. It's not exactly the same all the time, but it's very similar. I like to start off by saying, and if you don't mind, I'd like to include you in my prayer. So Heavenly Father, I want to thank you for another day clean here today, for all of us here. I want to thank you for all the blessings that you've put in our lives. I want to ask you to please help us to see, to share, and to be good stewards with those blessings. Lord, I pray that you would forgive us of our transgressions, our sins. Please help us to become the men and women that you would have us be. I ask you, Lord, to please help us to live in the truth, and please show us your will for us, and give us the willingness and the strength, the courage to carry that out. I pray, Lord, that you would use each of us to help build your kingdom here on earth. And I pray that that all of your children, that they would find the joy, the peace, the love, and the freedom that we found in you. Pray for all of your children that their needs would all be met, and that you'd use us to help make some of that happen, especially when we don't want to. Pray for healing, Lord, and for all your children, that they would come to find peace in you. It's in your name that we pray. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to start with that. I don't do a lot of really impressive things on my own, but when I ask for help, I usually am pleased with the results. And I want to tell you a little bit about what I was like. I hope to tell you a little bit about what happened to me and what my life is like today. You know, when I think about my early experience with things that changed the way I feel, I remember as a young child having a cough and my mom giving me some cough medicine. And the cough medicine that she gave me was from a large brown bottle. Maybe some of you grew up with the same kind of thing. And it was prescribed. There was some codeine in it. There was something in it. It was for my dad, and my mom could see that I was suffering with a cough, and she wanted her child to not have to suffer. And so she gave me a little bit of that medication. And I didn't really know what was in that bottle, but I knew two things. I knew that there was a taste that I liked, that they put some kind of flavor in it, and I knew that I really liked the way it made me feel. You know, I mean, I didn't like having the cold and having the cough. But there was a warm feeling that I got inside. It made me feel, I don't know that I really knew what it made me feel, but I just liked it. And as I've had the opportunity to do inventory and to look back at some things, I find that as I look back at those times, I don't know if any of you have ever done this, but I actually faked a cough a couple times. You know, and I also, sometimes my sisters would get a cough, and my mom would get that medication out, and it didn't always sit out. I don't know where she put it, but it would come out, and I would notice when mom left it on the lower shelf. And even when I didn't have a cough, I'd help myself to some of that cough syrup. And again, I just liked the way it made me feel. And this was to start a pattern of behavior that I was not aware of. A little bit later on, one of my sisters had some teeth pulled, and she was given some Percodan. That was back when they gave out that kind of stuff. And my sister didn't really have a tolerance for it, so they had to break it into pieces. And I don't know what compelled me to think that I might like it, but I tried one of those pills, and boy, did I like it. I didn't have access to things like that very often growing up, but when I did, I took advantage of it. And, you know, one of the most memorable experiences I have was growing up was at a 7th or 8th grade dance. And I remember getting out of school on a Friday and getting ready to go to that dance and being really excited and had my eye on a couple of different pretty girls, and I wanted to ask them to dance. And I went home that night, that afternoon after school. I get showered up. I think I actually shaved a couple times. Now, I was in 7th or 8th grade. I didn't have anything to shave at the time. And used Dad's Aqua Velva, you know, and did my hair just to make it look right and had my favorite shirt on. And I went to the dance, and I had great plans for that dance. I was going to have such a great time. And I walked in there, and I saw those girls, and they seemed to be talking about me, and it wasn't nice. I was sure that's what they were talking about. And I was afraid to go and ask one of them to dance because I was afraid that they might reject me. And so I today still will go to great measures to avoid rejection. Even when I'm being more healthy, I still really don't like that. And so what I did is I stood at that dance with my back against the wall, and I watched the other kids having fun, and I wanted so desperately to be part of it, and I just didn't have the courage to do it. And a couple years later, in high school, I went to my first high school dance, and I was there with some older kids, and when they picked me up, there was some beer rolling around in the back bottom floorboard of the car, and I knew what beer was, but I really didn't like the way it tasted, I don't remember if I'd ever really been drunk before, but I knew they were doing that, and I wanted to fit in, right? And so I asked them if I could have some, and I drank some of that, and we went into the dance, and I had the time of my life, man. I asked some of the girls who were dating the football players to dance. I mean, I asked all the girls to dance, and I had a great time, and I was convinced that everybody else had a great time. And you know, that night, I got back to my home, and the next morning I woke up, I didn't have a hangover, I didn't drink that much, I didn't have a hangover, I hadn't been in any fights, there was no broken relationships, there were no wrecked cars, there were no lost jobs, I didn't see any consequence from my behavior the night before. In fact, if anything, I came to believe something that many, many years later I would find was a great consequence I paid to that night. The thing that happened to me that night of great consequence to me is I began to live a lie. Actually, there were two of them. One of the lies was that when I put something in my system to change the way I feel, you like me better. And the other lie was that when I put something that changes the way I feel into my system, I think I become better. I become smarter, I become braver, I become stronger, I become better looking, I become all the things that I'm afraid I'm not. And I didn't know, but that night I began to live a believer in those two lies. And so for the next 25 years, every chance I got to put something in my system to change the way I felt, I did it because I needed to. And I didn't even know it. And I never, because I did that, I never learned how to cope with problems like all the other kids who grew up not doing that did. And so I became dependent on changing the way that I feel. And at first, it didn't seem like a big deal, you know. I didn't get into a lot of trouble. I narrowly escaped a lot of trouble, frankly. And it's funny because narrowly escaping a lot of trouble tends to create some other problems, at least in my thinking, because I start to think that I'm better than people who pay consequences. I think that the rules don't apply to me. I think that that I'm smarter or better than people who get into trouble because they're obviously not smart enough or good enough to keep from getting caught. And so that just propels more and more of the same behavior. And what starts to happen is I start to have these, I'd call them brownouts, right? Like, you know, like maybe this ever, this happened a couple times in high school, but it started happening more and more later on. You have your friend call you up and he'd go, "Dude, do you remember what you said to those girls last night?" And I'm like, "No, what girls?" and you know, at first it was kind of funny because usually it was kind of something silly and nobody got hurt. And then later on it started getting to be less silly and less fun and it started to be hurtful. And I didn't remember it. And in fact, you know, the first time that happened to me that I didn't remember what happened the night before, it gave me a little cause for alarm, not a lot, but it gave me a little cause for alarm. I thought, wow, you know, that's probably not a good thing. And I know today that most people that don't suffer from the same condition that I suffer from, when they experience that, sometimes that's all it takes, and they don't do the stuff that I do anymore. They've had enough. I got a brother-in-law that, I won't tell his story. But ever since the night that he got into a little bit of trouble from his drinking, he's never had a drink since. Has no desire for it. I don't get that. He gives up too easy, doesn't he?
No.
Anyway, quitter, right? So this pattern starts to develop. In fact, I get into this pattern where if I do remember what happened the night before, it's odd. I don't know if you can relate to that, but you know, having the it's now turning into blackouts where I just don't remember sometimes more than a day. I really don't have any idea what happened. And that's become a normal thing, and I'm not even questioning it anymore. And I know today from talking to people who don't suffer from the conditions that I suffer from, that is highly irregular behavior. Normal people, and if you define normal people as more than 68% of the human population, more than 68% of the human population does not behave like I just described. They don't do it. But I did. And a lot of the people around me did. So I didn't even know about those other people. I'm surrounded by people that do the things I do because I don't like hanging around with people that have a couple of drinks or do a couple of pills. Or I mean, I went to a friend's house one time. I walked in. It was like 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning. I wasn't planning on getting any kind of party started, but I went over to visit the guy, and he said, "Hey, would you like a beer?" And I thought, well, I mean, nothing else going on, okay. So we go back to the kitchen. He opens the refrigerator, and I can see there are two beers there. You know it's time to leave, right? There's two beers there. There's nothing else left to do here. It's time to go get some more, right? Am I the only one that does that? You guys got quiet on me. I thought maybe other... So what happens as a result of my behavior is I start to have more and more consequences. And you know, the funny thing is that a lot of my friends got in trouble with the law. They lost jobs. They lost families like that. None of that stuff ever happened to me for a couple of reasons. One, I never had a family. I was the kind of guy that, you know, if she started talking about my drinking being a problem, time to get a new sheet. Because we're not going to talk about the drink. My drink is not a problem for me. I'm cool, man. You know? And I never told them about the other stuff. The drinking was always kind of thing that was on the surface, you know, because it was legal. You know, I worry about, I shouldn't worry. I'm glad I'm not active in the disease right now because I would be one of those marijuana card holding guys running around saying, "Ain't nothing wrong with me, man," you know. I would, because you know I can say it's legal. And I ran around with prescription bottles with narcotic pain medications in my pocket with tissue in there so the pills you couldn't hear them, right? for years. And again, I rationalized, well, this is prescribed by a doctor. There's nothing wrong with that, right? I couldn't seem to really rationalize or justify or explain away the meth. I mean, that was just, you know, it's like, that's just kind of a problem, right? I'm really lucky that I did get, I wasn't really addicted to meth. I mean, meth itself is just addictive, right? So I wasn't addicted to it. It's just a, you know what I mean, right? So, I'm spending more money than I have coming in to get that meth to keep my habit up, because when I run out, I find that my life gets so dark that I can't stand it. I'll do anything to get some more because I got to get back up, man. I cannot do this down stuff. I cannot do it. And, you know, my family saw what was happening to me. I had lost about 30 pounds or so. I lost my front tooth. I was looking sexy. And I had a crazy job anyway, but I almost wish I would have videotaped myself, you know, back at the height of my insanity, because I think sometimes it's hard for me to even imagine just how crazy I was. I have people like Bobby here that came with me who saw me when I was doing that. So, but just crazy behavior, and my family saw it, and fortunately they took a risk and they asked me to get help. You know, I swore I always wanted a surprise party, but that was really not what I had in mind. You know. My family showed up and they said, dude, you're freaking crazy, man. You're off the tracks and you need to go get some help. And if you don't, we're done with you, right? And I'm a pretty social person. I didn't want to be done with my family. And frankly, if you want to know the truth, I was running out of money quick. And I really didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't want to buy the last several bags that I bought because I knew I didn't have the money for it, but I couldn't not do it, you know. I just couldn't not do it. Hey, by the way, any of you ever have some of that stuff that gets washed in gasoline? You ever have some of that? So I hope you, I'm sorry to hear that, but you know what happened to me is the guy brought a big fat sack of that stuff, right, and we lined it out and did it, and I said, oh, dude, this is crazy. I mean, I know gasoline is not good for whatever's up there. Can't be good. This is like poison, right? I mean, this is poison. I tell him, you get that out of here and bring some good stuff. Wait a minute, I got to get one more before you go. That's one memory that I have of very clearly how insane I was. Now whether you think that particular variation of the chemicals I was using was any worse than any of the others isn't important. I knew that what I was putting into my body at that time was very, very dangerous for me. And I couldn't not put it in my body. I've heard, you know, you said something that really got my attention. You said that that the program's not for the people who need it, it's for the people who want it. I'll tell you, from my experience, it wasn't any good for me when I wanted it either. The program of Narcotics Anonymous hasn't done me any good until I did it. I was coming in and out of the fellowship. I got nicknames because of the ridiculous behavior that people were watching me in. And I went through another relapse, and I didn't know what to do, man. And I knew I couldn't. I did not want to continue living the way I was living. And I didn't seem to have the courage to end my own life. But those thoughts were flashing before me regularly. And I showed up out of habit at an Alano club in Visalia. I went there not because I wanted to get clean, not because I had any virtue in me. I went there because my alarm clock went off. And for the last 4.5, 6 months, whatever it was, every morning I got up and went there. And so I got up and went there out of habit. Nothing more than habit. And I got there, on my way there, I'm thinking, man, nobody's got to know. Nobody's got to know. Nobody's got to know. And the weight of that lie was just killing me. And So I get to the room, and for the first time, they asked me to do the little daily reflection thing before the meeting. And so I read that, and by the time I'm done reading it, I'm crying in front of a bunch of strangers. And I said, I did it again, man. I did it again. And I don't know what to do. And somebody there said, well, call your sponsor. And right? And so I did. I called my sponsor, and I was afraid of what he might say. I didn't know what to expect, but I didn't expect him to wrap his arms gently around me and show me love. It's not what I expected. What he did is he said, well, you know, what do you want to do? What do you want to do? I mean, you know, there's a very clear defined process by which you can recover or you can keep doing what you want to do. And I said, okay, anything, just show me. And the way I've been sponsored is through a series of assignments. And my sponsor asked me some questions, asked me to write the answers to them. And from that day to this, I've done my very, very best every single day to do some kind of step work. Now, I got to be honest with you. Some days, my very best is pretty piss poor. That's the truth. But I haven't stopped doing it, with one exception. The one time I stopped doing it was my first sponsor took me through the 12 steps, and we finished right at the one-year mark. And by the way, please don't hear anything I'm not saying here. I don't know how long it's supposed to take you to do your steps. I don't know if you're supposed to do them 100 times. I don't know none of that. I'm not here to tell you about what you ought to do. I'm here to tell you about what I've done. In the first 12 months, I went through the 12 steps. I used the step working guide. And then I took about 4 months off from step work. I kept going to meetings. I was going to quite a few meetings at that time. I think at the height I was going to like 24 meetings a week. And that could be a problem in its own right, I suppose. But I wasn't burdened with employment. So, you know, I was able to do that. I took about 4 months off, and I found myself kind of getting a little squirrely, and I thought, I don't know what to do next, but I know what worked the first 12 months, so I'm just going to do it again. And I've continued to take that approach. And at the present moment, I'm working through a fourth step again. I want to tell you how many times I've gone through the steps because I want to impress you. Oh, I so desperately want to impress you. But that's not really what's important. What is important for me is that I continue to stay around people who are moving in the same positive direction. And as a result of those things, my life has changed in so many ways that it would take me another hour to tell you all of them. But I want to try to tell you a few because I think that's an important part of what we do here. I gotta hopefully give you some kind of idea about what you can have hope for. I came here and I was really angry with my father. Probably the first reason I was angry with him was because I felt betrayed because he and I used to drink together, and where's he coming at me with, you know, I've got a drinking problem, you know? And my dad was, you know, he was never one of those, you know, squinty-eyed drug-using folk, you know? You know the kind? I don't know if you guys know the kind. But alcohol, dude, would tear it up. And so I thought I learned how to drink from my dad. I only know from actually looking at the truth that that's really not true. My dad did drink a fair amount. There were times when he drank an awful lot, and there were lots of times when he doesn't drink, and he doesn't seem to have a problem drinking. Like I have problems with drugs. But I felt really betrayed by my father, and so I was very angry with him. And through the process of going through the third and fourth steps, I sought some outside help for some mental health issues. As a result of doing that work, I was reacquainted with some violence between my father and I. And so I now had a new reason to be angry at my father. And I have to tell you that for me, being a victim is a wonderful way to get a lot of power. I can make myself a victim of anybody for anything, and somehow I rise to some position of power in doing so. And so I could tell you guys about all the horrible things that my dad did to me, get you to side with me, and we'll go get them, you know? And So I was very angry with him, and in the first about 2 years of my recovery, the staying clean part, right? I didn't feel comfortable around my dad. I was afraid of what he might do. I was afraid of he was always a very big, big personality, and there was violence between us, and I was afraid that might come up again. And he's a little smaller than me now, but he's a tough guy. I still don't want to tangle with him. But I was worried about that. I was also worried about saying something I would really regret. And so I didn't feel safe to go around him. And I got to about the two-year mark, and I must have heard somebody say this, because I'm not this smart on my own. But somebody put the idea in my head that I asked this question. I said, well, if you had a son, what would you like that relationship to look like? And then that got turned around and said, well, what kind of son are you being? Are you being the kind of son that you would want to have? And that opened my eyes, and I thought, wow, you know, I would really not want to have a son that is keeping me out of his life. And so I was stuck with a dilemma, because I wanted to be the kind of son that I would want to have, but I also was in a great deal of fear about that relationship. And so, again, I'm sure I didn't come up with this by myself, and I'm going to some men's SAG meetings every week, and I'm with a lot of fellowship, and I'm going through steps with sponsors, and I'm going to see a therapist, and somehow out of all of that, the idea comes up that maybe I should invite my dad to have lunch, because, see, for me, that was a bit of a safe environment, because it had a start and an end time. It was a public place, and so I could go with that. And so I went, and I started having lunch with my dad, and I was afraid he'd bring up subjects that I didn't want to talk about. And it was a therapist, I remember, who told me, when I told her I was worried that he might say something about this or that, and she said, well, if he does, what could you do? And I was like, you know, I'm thinking, I don't know, burst into flames, you know? And she said, well, could you change the subject? I never thought of that. Something as simple as that, you know? You don't like the way the conversation's going, you change the subject. And so a couple of times my dad and mom had been divorced since I was young, and there's still some stuff there, and I don't like to get put in the middle of it, so invariably something about my mom would come up, and I would say, hey, how about those Notre Dame Fighting Irish? And my dad would just, off into Notre Dame land you go. And so that's worked out really, really well, and that works out really well for lots of relationships. I have sponsees that come to me and ask me silly questions, and sometimes I'll send them on the Notre Dame path, you know. But over the period of time between then and now, those lunches have continued. And in fact, now it started off being like once every month or every other month, and now my dad and I have a fixed date. Every Tuesday we get together for lunch. And you know, this men's group that I'm a part of in Tulare, it's called the Friends of Jimmy K. It's the best home group that exists in my mind. And so I remember going to that Friends of Jimmy K meeting one day, and my dad had asked me he has season tickets to a football game, and he said, hey, you want to go to this football game? Well, the last time I'd been to that stadium, I was smoking meth in the bathroom and just insanely drunk, and I was afraid of that environment, and I was afraid of being around him, and so I went to the group and I said, hey, my dad invited me to this thing, and I'm not really sure. I kind of think maybe the next time he asks, I'll take him up on it. And one of the guys in the group said, hey, champ, why don't you invite your dad to a game and you buy the tickets? And I got to do that. But see, I don't think of stuff like that on my own. So I'm having this relationship with my father, and it's getting better. It's getting better. And one day we're talking on the phone, and, you know, it occurred to me that I hadn't done what most people in a loving relationship like that do at the end of the conversation. I hadn't said, love you, Dad. And And I thought maybe that's something that I should try. And so at the end of the conversation, I said, "Hey, Dad, I love you. Talk to you later." And I caught him off. I caught him flat-footed. You know, he got a click, right? And so, but the next time we had the conversation, and I said it again, and I was afraid to say it again because it felt like a rejection, you know. I said it again, and he said, "I love you too, son." And then came the time when he said, "I'm proud of you, son, and I love you." That's all I ever wanted to hear. And it was just a couple of months after that happened, and my father had a stroke, and he can't talk very well. He's learning again, but he lost the ability to talk. And you know what? The guys in my home group said to me, "Don't wait. Don't wait for your dad to invite you. Don't wait to tell your dad. Don't wait for him to tell you that he loves you. Get in there and do that stuff." And I can't thank the program Narcotics Anonymous enough for the life that they've given me. I mean, today, my mom had to, I put my mom in a really shitty position, see, because what I used to do is I used to take pills out of my grandmother's house, right, and my aunt and everybody else, right? And so my grandmother is starting to go through some dementia, and she's having trouble keeping track of, you know, the pills you're supposed to take and stuff. And so she thinks she's missing some blood pressure medication. Now, I don't know about you guys, I'm not really into the whole blood pressure. That's just not my buzz, you know? But what happened is she thought she was missing some, and there was like one likely candidate, right? So, I mean, you know, and so I put my grandmother in a position. And by the way, growing up all those years, my grandmother said, you know, she slipped out a couple times and said I was her favorite grandkid. You know, I mean, you know, you're not supposed to say that, right? But I was the first grandson and the first grandchild in the family, and my grandmother's always had a soft spot for me, and it just tore her up that I was doing this. I was taking those medications from her, and so when her heart pressure medication stuff started missing, her blood pressure medication started missing, she called her daughter. She didn't know how to confront me, so she called my mom, her daughter, and said, "Stuff missing. I can't really have this. Your son's not allowed in my house anymore." And so not only did I get to put my grandmother through that, but I also got to put my mom through that. My mom had to call me, and she had to say, "You're not welcome at grandma's house anymore. You can't be trusted." Now, I can tell you, and you can choose to believe it or not, but I didn't take the blood pressure medication. And in fact, by the time the blood pressure medication issue came up, I was clean for 6 or 7 minutes or a day or, you know, whatever. I was clean for a couple weeks maybe. I don't know. It wasn't that long. And somehow enough of what I had been told by that time affected how I responded. And I told my mom, I said, "Hey, Mom, you know what? That's fair." I said, "It doesn't matter. I didn't take it. It doesn't matter. I'm not going to argue. I'm not going to go to grandma. I'm not going to create any stress. You know what? I totally get it. And I'm sorry that you had to go through that. And I hope to prove to you through my behavior that that's not who I am." And about 6 months ago, my mom asked me if I would be the executor of her estate. Now, I've got three perfectly capable, sober in the sense of sane, reliable, trustworthy sisters. And my mom chose me. Man, my life is just not even the same. Not even close to the same. And I have you guys to thank for it. And I want to say one last thing, and that is one of the things that I really struggle with today. Because you know what? I do get kind of, "God damn it, I took the steps. You need to take the steps." I do fall into that pit. And that's not attractive, man. It wasn't attractive when people were coming to me with it. You know, it's not the way my sponsor responded to me when I was willing to finally do it, you know. And I think it's critically important that I find a way to be a part of the attraction to this program. I want you to want to come and see me at a meeting. I want you to want to come and share your fourth or fifth step with me. Because you trust me. Because you've seen what happened in my life and you want the same for yours. And that's not always easy. But it's a goal. And you guys have taught me that if I set reasonable, achievable goals, I can accomplish them. One example, and I'll finish with this. After the meth episode ended, I got into the ice cream episode. And I went from 170 pounds to 250 pounds. So was that 80 pounds? Put on 80 pounds. And I held that 80 pounds on for 6.5, almost 7 years. In the last 12 months and a couple of days, I've been applying reasonable efforts to eat a little bit less and to exercise just a little bit more. Not to go to the gym 6 days a week because I'm not going to. It's not sustainable. I'm not going to do it. I go to the gym 2 days a week. It's a huge accomplishment, I think, for me that it's no longer my vocabulary to say word. I don't say pain. I say discomfort. I no longer say I hate the gym. But I go twice a week. That's just all I'm up for. But I'm getting to where I like it. And it's really become a priority. Normally Thursday night's my gym night. So you gotta know how important you guys are to me tonight. So thank you, for allowing me to be here, and God bless.